Did King David ever see his great grandmother?
No.
I don't know. Probably not. I don't know. That's a very interesting question.
I think some is not.
Some is not here. Here, no. Here it's going to be a little different. Okay. Marlene? I'm sorry to interrupt myself.
Are you coming to Shabbaton?
Marlene, could you ask Mark or Phyllis to find me something? Usually like the stone or the Hirsch has the Book of Ruth in it. If you're able
to. Would you like just to have the Book of Ruth?
That would be great.
Here.
That's all I need. Okay. Okay, fine. So, what I'd like to do tonight, in the... What I'd like to do tonight is I'd like to under the final goal of this year would be try to figure out a way to explore, it's not such an obvious point, how it is that Ruth connects to David more than just that she's a great-grandmother. What's the deep sort of spiritual, essential connection between Ruth and David? Between Ruth, I'm so confused, how do I say it? Okay, I think I'm going to go with Ruth. I apologize to the Spartan. I have to be true to myself.
Say Ruth and just, you know.
So, what is that deep connection between Ruth and David? Along the way, we're going to learn some very key ideas in the Book of Ruth. Because I sort of feel walking into Shavuos and not talking about Ruth, not talking about her, especially in a woman's shir, would be a bit of a travesty. And it's also, we need to prepare for Shavuos. And Shavuos is sort of the stepchild of all the holidays, in the sense of we prepare for Shavuos. You know, the average Jewish homemaker basically finds Shavuos to be like a cakewalk. You know, it's like after Pesach, what is it? You know,
yeah, cheesecake walk.
Right. So it's not terribly difficult, and in the sense of preparation. So what we put in is what we get out, and we need to prepare in order to take something out of the holiday of Shavuos. And we know that it is a very strong custom, minhag Ashkenaz, to read the Book of Ruth on Shavuos, and even though I believe in most Sephardic communities they do not read the Book of Ruth on Shavuos, there is certainly, there is certainly a strong connection between the Book of Ruth and Shavuot. Is that true? Did I represent authentically the Sephardic customs? You're not sure. Rabbi Lebar, I think, informed me that the Sephardim do not read it. However, I think there are probably Sephardic congregations that do read it. But they also, he's Canadian, but he's celebrating because the Canadians won again, which is not for this year, but it's a big miracle, second series in a row. Now, what I want to tell you is that the Book of Ruth is obviously supposed to be connected to the holiday of Shavuos, but it's not so obvious how it is. Right now, I'm going to work with the basic assumption that we know the storyline, but I'm going to just give just a one minute summary of that book. Okay, so the Book of Ruth starts with the scene of a man by the name of Elimelech. And Elimelech has two sons, and their names are Mahlon and Kilion. And Mahlon and Kilion, and Elimelech and his wife Naomi, they leave the land of Israel, and they go to the plains of Moab. It's a time of great famine. And Elimelech leaves, and he's there, and his kids marry. Well, they're not too many. saw you at Sinai type of situations going on there. And what happens is that they marry two Moabite women. One, Mahlon marries Rut, and Kilion marries Orpah. And there is a whole discussion whether or not Rut and Orpah converted before they got married. It's a very interesting question, which we've discussed in previous years. But leaving that aside, this was either a halachic marriage or it was a de facto marriage. And they're married. What happens is they don't live happily ever after. Elimelech dies, Mahlon and Kilion dies, and Naomi is left with her two daughters-in-law in the plains of Moab. And Naomi finds out that that Hashem has remembered his people, the famine is over, and she decides she's going to return back home. And this is maybe the most famous scene in the book, as she decides to return back home, she turns to Ruth and Orpah, and she says, "What are you doing?" She says, "Stay in Moab, don't come back with me. I don't have any more children to give you, and what are you going to wait around? Are you going to be an old maid? It's not going to work. No, you should stay here in Moab." And Ruth and Orpah say, "No, we're going with you." And there's one famous scene, and what happens in the famous scene? What happens is that Orpah gives her mother-in-law a kiss, right? She says goodbye, and she turns around and she goes back. And Ruth clings to her mother-in-law, the famous lines, "Your nation is Amech Ami, Elokayach Elokai, your nation is my nation, your God is my God, wherever you shall sleep, I shall sleep," right? "I'm with you, till death do us part." And then she goes, and it's difficult for Naomi because she has nobody to make parnasa, no way to sustain herself. But Naomi has a relative, and the name of this relative is Boaz. What is the relationship between Boaz and Naomi? It doesn't say that explicitly in the text. But Rashi tells us that Boaz is first cousins with Naomi. Why? So if you could just sort of like remember this for now, this will come in a little bit later on. Because Elimelech is one of four brothers. Okay? Elimelech is the first character of the story. He's the one who marries Naomi, right? Elimelech is one of four brothers. One brother is Elimelech. The other one is Salmon. Salmon, okay, that's his name. Salmon happens to be Boaz's father. Okay. Then there's another one who is not named in the book. And he's called in the book of Ruth Ploni Almoni, which is like the classic Jewish name for John Doe. Ploni Almoni. It's just like, it's an undescriptive name. I'll tell you why that name comes up in a few moments. And finally, the fourth brother, we are just told, is the father of Naomi. So if you figure out the math, if Salmon is the father of Boaz, right, and Salmon has a brother who's the father of Naomi, so that means Naomi and Boaz are first cousins, okay? It also means, if you figure this out, that Elimelech married his niece. Elimelech married his niece. Remember, because Elimelech is the one in the fourth, right? Elimelech married his niece, and which is legal procedure in Judaism, and what happens is, so Naomi sends Ruth to Boaz. She sends him to Boaz and says, "He's a relative. He's a good guy, and maybe you can get some food from him." And what happens is that Ruth acts in a very modest way. Boaz is very taken by Ruth. He sees that she's different than everybody else. And Boaz finds out who Ruth is. He puts the story together. And she gets from him a nice amount of food to bring back. I think the language of the text is Eifa Seorim, which is a nice measurement of barley. So fine. So when Naomi sees that Ruth is so successful, So she goes, where did he go? She said, I went to Boaz, and he did. He, this is what he gave me. So Naomi ups the ante. What does Naomi do? What does she? What does I mean when I say she ups the ante? She says, this is what you should do.
Yeah.
Get dressed up nicely, right? And you should sleep when he is in the time of watching the barley, the grain. Go to his feet, go near his feet, and you should go to sleep by him. And Boaz, and she says, and Naomi says, Ruth says, whatever you say, I'll do. And she goes and she lays down in her nice clothing, laying down next to Boaz. Boaz wakes up. And he's somewhat startled, the text tells us. Vayilafet, vayecharad, whatever the exact term is, he's very startled. And she says, I am coming, ufarasta knafecha, and I want you to extend your kanaf, your cloak, and bring me in. Because this is what my mother-in-law has told me to do. And I want you to come, and I want to be married to you. Now, there's a whole issue. You might have heard of this concept in halacha called yibum. What is yibum?
I'm marrying you.
Marrying the deceased's widow.
Yeah.
So that doesn't fit exactly here because it's not exactly. But the concept of yibum, at least not on a purely halachic level, but on a custom, is if you can't do it with the brother-in-law, if the brother-in-law can't marry. In other words, if that is not available, then you go to the closest relative. And that's called, Rashi tells us, that's called the minhag of Yibum, the custom of Yibum. So what happens is that Boaz says to Ruth something very interesting. He says, blessed are you to God. This kindness is even greater than the kindness that you did to your... this kindness is even greater than your first kindness. I'll explain what that means. But he says, I can't marry you, because there's somebody who comes before me. And who is that?
His brother.
That is my brother, whom we don't know in the text. His name is Ploni Almoni. Right, that's my brother, whose name is Ploni Almoni. I didn't say it right. That's my uncle. It's my uncle, whose name is Ploni Almoni. And he gets first dibs, because he's closest... he's closer to me. You know, I'm just a cousin with Naomi. I'm just a cousin, and you're the daughter-in-law of Naomi, and he's closer. He's not a cousin, he's an uncle. So he gets first. What happens? In the end, this Ploni Almoni declines the offer. Does not want to marry Ruth. Boaz marries Ruth, and in the end, Boaz has a child. And the name of that child is... Oved, okay? The name of that child is Oved, and we are told that Oved has a child by the name of Yishai, and Yishai has a child by the name of David. Okay, so if Boaz and Ruth have Oved, and Oved has Yishai, and Yishai has David, that makes Ruth the great-grandmother of David, Melech HaMashiach. So this is the famous story of the Book of Ruth. The question that many ask is, why has there been a custom, at least among Ashkenazim, and probably as well among some Sephardim, why is there a custom to read this very beautiful and dramatic book on Shavuos? What's the basis of that custom? And there are many different suggestions that are given. What have you heard about this question? At this point, feel free to respond. What's that?
There's nothing left. She's making a joke.
Okay.
Well, I heard that because Ruth was willing to completely drop her princess status in Moab in order to follow Naomi because of her commitment to the Torah, that we can be inspired in the same way that, you know, that she was literally willing to give up everything and go live a life of poverty so she could be connected to a Torah life.
Beautiful idea. And that is, if you take a look at the sheets that I handed out to you, stapled the first page, that is... one of five reasons that I present here in source number 2, why do we read Rus on Shavuos? And it's quoted, just the second paragraph, it says, Magen Avram, just I'm going to read the English, and what connection does the Megillah of Rus have with Shavuos, that it is read on Shavuos at the time of the giving of the Torah, to teach you that Torah was only given through suffering and impoverishment. Now, suffering sounds a lot worse in Hebrew, in English, than it does in Hebrew. Suffering in the sense that sometimes, or every time, when you want to acquire a great value, you need to give up something, or you need to sacrifice. So I would say, really, if I had to translate it better, I would probably have written through sacrifice and impoverishment. Ruth sacrificed a tremendous amount. So that is one connection. What else? Yes?
Ruth picked up the part of the harvest from the edges of the field, right? Didn't
right.
she go there to
right.
And springtime.
And Shavuos is about the harvest. That's a very classic idea, and that is the first concept that is presented on this sheet here in the name of the Avudraham and others. What else? Any other ideas? Why we read the book of Rus and Shavuos? So just to give you another two very important ideas is that the book of Shavuos, the book of Rus, is all about a convert, conversion. And, of course, what happened on Shavuos? We converted to Judaism, all of us.
Right?
So, in fact, there are many different connections between Rus, the convert, and Matan Torah, the receiving of the Torah. The most obvious is we had to accept the mitzvos, just like Rus had to accept the mitzvos. So that's another point of connection. A fourth fascinating connection also presented in the second box here on the first page is that it's the fourth paragraph. Name the it's not in the it's not I didn't translate in English. It's underlined Hatam Lefi She David Hamelech Olav Hashalom Meis Ba'atzeres. Because King David, our tradition tells us, died on Shavuos. He was born on Shavuos, he died on Shavuos. So what does that have to do with Rus? Because Rus, we just pointed out, was the great-grandmother of David. So, and I guess it's shorter to read the book of Rus than it is to read the book of Shmuel. Right? The book of Shmuel is, even just Shmuel 1 is 31 chapters, and the whole Shmuel is 60, whatever it is. So it's a little bit shorter version. So we're going to read the book of Rus to remind us that David, his yahrzeit is on Shavuos. It has to be a little bit deeper than that, but that's the famous concept. And then the last one that I want to present to you is that the Torah is so beautiful. So beautiful. You're going to see where I'm going with this in a moment. Because the book of Rus, the Medrash says, doesn't seem to have really any halachos. So then what's the essence of the book of Rus? The essence of the book of Rus is it's completely chesed. It's all about kindness. And says the Medrash in a most stunning and beautiful way. And the Torah also is all about chesed. The Torah begins with kindness. Its midpoint is kindness. And its end is kindness. How is the Torah, how does the Torah begin with kindness? Not so obvious, yeah? How is the beginning of Bereishis kindness?
Yes, Hashem. Out of love, he created this world.
Very nice. Beautiful idea. He created the world. That's a chesed. The Medrash says a few different ideas. The Medrash says, God made the first shidduch. Very beautiful Medrash. It actually is found if you converse it in Hebrew. The Medrash says, in the Tchilosa chesed, Shegomal chesed l'chassanim u'lekalos. God created the first shidduch, right? It's a tremendous chesed to find somebody a partner, find somebody a mate. That's one act of chesed. A second act of chesed, the Medrash develops that very incredible concept about chesed and kala in a most beautiful way. A second version in the Medrash, which I did not put here, is that God gave clothing to Adam and Eve. So that's a tremendous kindness also. The Medrash says, the middle of the Torah is kindness. Why the middle of the Torah is kindness? Because when Devorah, the maidservant of Rivka, died, so the Medrash says that Yaakov was crying. And God says, how can I let Yaakov cry alone? I need to visit God. I need to visit him. So God was Menachem Avel. God comforted the mourner. So that's chesed also. It's a tremendous chesed to not let a person be in their sadness alone. And finally, the Medrash says, the end of the Torah is chesed, because when Moshe died, nobody was to know his burial spot. And you could probably imagine why.
Yeah.
Why is nobody to know Moshe's burial spot?
They
because they'll make Moshe into a god. Right? So, therefore, says the Medrash, nobody knows his burial spot, then who buried him? So, the one answer to that question, the Medrash says, is God buried him. God buried Moshe. So, the book of the Torah begins, ends, and in its middle has kindness. And so, too, the book of Rus is all about kindness. So what are the five reasons we said about why we read the book of Rus on Shavuos? Number one idea is because it's this harvest time. And the second idea is what? Because it ties us into to King David. And the third idea is it's all about to acquire Torah. Requires incredible what? Incredible sacrifice. And the fourth idea is that we all converted. And the fifth idea is that the Torah is kindness and the book of Rus is kindness. So let's try to take these ideas, or some of them, and let's try to forge a connection between David, Rus, the Mashiach, and Shavuos. Yes?
Once again, what does harvest have to do with the book, reading the book? I'm sorry.
No, that's fantastic. It's a good question. Because the book of Rus, much of it takes place in the field with the gleaning of the poor people's, sort of like they're gleaning the wheat and the grain, etc. Okay, so I want to first, and there are different scenes we could look at, but I want to first share with you an amazing scene that some of you might be familiar with. In previous shiurim, I've discussed this. And if you turn the page, we're going to look at the English. And I want to give you the background. It's the first source on the second page, and the background is, and I'm going to go move through this quickly. The background is that we're now looking at King David. And if you remember, King David, he was a giant slayer, right? He wipes out Goliath. And after he wipes out Goliath, Shaul, who knew who David was, Shaul gave him permission. Shaul asks a very peculiar question. He says, Ben Mize Hanar, who is this Nar, or who is he the son of? But what's really strange is that King David and David, who was not yet known to be the king, and Shaul have had many points of convergence. David used to play music in Shaul's court. David had just smitten Goliath. Shaul knew who David was, and Shaul knew who David's father was. So why is he saying, who is he the son of? So the Medrash portrays a very incredible dialogue. And here, let's look at it inside. Says the Medrash, it is this that Shaul meant. He wanted to know whether he descended from Peretz or from Zerach. Now, do the names Peretz and Zerach mean anything to you? Tamar had two children in her union with Yehuda.
She had twins.
And their names were Peretz and Zerach. And the name Peretz should be familiar to you, because we often speak about the name Peretz in the context of the Mashiach. And one famous thing is, again, I don't expect everybody here to be at the Friday night services, but we say, in Lecha Dodi, we say, Ben Partzi, V'nismecha V'nagila, the son of Peretz is going to come, and then we'll be very happy. The Mashiach, our tradition tells us, comes from Yehuda, comes from David, but we don't know that yet. He comes from David, he comes from Yehuda, and he comes from Peretz. Two children, Peretz and Zerach, and Peretz bears the Messianic line, and Zerach doesn't. So comes Shaul, and he's beginning to get very nervous. Why? Because Shaul, at this point, was already told by Shmuel that he was no longer going to be the king. In other words, he failed in his mission to wipe out Amalek, and Shaul was told by Shmuel, that's it, your days are short-lived, and somebody's going to replace you. But Shaul has no idea who's going to replace him. He has no idea when. Shaul looking around, he's surveying the terrain, and he begins to think, maybe it's this David kid. So he asks the question, says the Medrash, who is this David? Where does he come from? Does he come from Peretz? Or does he come from Zerachna? How does he know that he even comes from one of those two possibilities? Because he knows that his father is Yishai, and he knows that Yishai comes from the tribe of Yehuda. How does he know that? Because Yishai lived in a place called Beit Lechem in Yehuda, in the tribe of Yehuda. So he knew he was from Yehuda, but he didn't know which family we came from. He didn't have his genealogy tree, didn't go to the to Ellis Island online, so he didn't know. So he had a very good question. So comes the Medrash and says as follows. If he descended from Peretz, he would be king, for a king breaks for himself away, and no one can hinder him. If, however, he descended from Zerach, he would only be an important man. What is the reason why he gave instructions that inquiry be made concerning him? So Doeg then said to him, Doeg, who's a very sinister character, who's a very brilliant person, the head of Shaul's cabinet, Doeg says to him, instead of inquiring whether he is fit to be a king or not, inquire rather whether he's permitted to enter the assembly or not. What does that mean, the assembly? Can he enter into the Jewish people? Is he allowed to marry a regular mainstream Jewish woman? Well, why not? Why should David not be allowed to marry a regular mainstream Jewish woman? Does anybody know why not?
Yeah, because...
Because Doug,
she was a convert.
Because Ruth was a convert. We're very nice to converts.
Moabite.
But she wasn't just a convert.
She was
a Moabite convert. So therefore comes Doeg and he says, she came from Ruth the Moabitess. Now, this is a few hundred years earlier. And everybody knew that Ruth, they knew that Ruth is an ancestor of David. And yet, Doeg is saying David is illegitimate because he descended from a Moabite convert. And the Torah says you cannot allow a Moabite and an Ammonite into the Jewish people. So Avner said to him...
But it was just the women.
Oh! So Avner says to him, no, we learned an Ammonite but not an Ammonitess. A Moabite but not a Moabitess. There's a whole discussion here. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Where Avner says, no. The halacha of the Torah is only the males can't come in, but the females can come in. They can. So Doeg says, oh, really? So then when it says in the Torah that a mamzer cannot enter a product of an adulterous or incestuous relationship, right? Incestuous relationship. So when it says in the Torah a mamzer cannot enter into the mainstream of the Jewish people, you mean only a male, not a female? Are you going to make that same? So what is he doing? He's fighting halachically. They say, no, that's different. So he says, why is that different? Because the reason why the Ammonites and the Moabites are not allowed into the Jewish people, anybody know why?
Because they didn't offer them food and water.
Very good, excellent. Because when the Jews were in the desert and they wanted to go into Eretz Yisrael, they were not offered basic amenities of bread and water by Moab. So therefore, says Doeg, so it applies to men and women. So then they respond back, no. The men are the ones that have to go out of the home and be the sort of the machers, the schleppers, etc. Even then they were schlepping the groceries. The men are the ones that bring the bread and the water, not the women. So therefore the Torah wouldn't exclude the women. So Doeg said, no. The men should have brought to the men, and the women should have brought to the women. And then everybody's silent, and Doeg has won. And if Doeg wins, David loses. So then Shaul turns to the crowd and he says, go into the Beis Medrash, go into the study hall and let's see what they say about this. And Doeg fights them all and he wins. And then the end of the story is that a man by the name of Amasa, who we're not going to go into who he was, Amasa walks into the Beis Medrash, and he takes out his sword. And he says like this. He says, I have a tradition from the house of Shmuel that the halacha is Amoni, Moavi, men can't enter, but Amoni, Moavi, women may enter. That's my tradition. If anybody would like to argue with me, please feel free. Right? So at this point, the argument stops, right? The argument stops because he has the sword. And that's how the Talmud ends. So what's going on with that? Well, you don't usually win the, we don't win the argument if you have the biggest weapon. So what the Talmud is teaching us is, you can't logically win this argument, but it was an oral tradition. It was an oral tradition, and therefore many claim the reason why Shmuel, who anointed David, wrote the book of Ruth. Shmuel is the author of the book of Ruth. Book of Ruth. Why did Shmuel write that book? Specifically to give the imprimatur, to give the sort of like, to give the stamp of approval. You see that Boaz, the Heiliga Boaz, the holy Boaz, he is the one, right, that marries Ruth. So therefore, it must be that it was all right. So according to many, that's why Shmuel actually wrote the book of Ruth. It was to give a heksher, to give his stamp of approval to King David. Wow. Well, now, that's very interesting. Like that sort of fuses together some of what we said earlier, right? It's about David, right? It's about Ruth. It's about acceptance of Ruth as a convert. But what's interesting is, it sort of highlights the obvious question, which is, why are we making a shidduch between a Moabite woman, and why does the and Boaz, who was the great tzaddik, and why does the Mashiach come from such a strange place? These are very famous questions. So let's take a look at another scene. So this is, I just want to, like, that scene is a fascinating sort of backdrop to what we're looking at here. Let's take a look at another scene. And this is, the scene that we're looking at now is on the bottom of that same second page. And this time, we are looking at the comment of the Medrash, which can be found in the very last paragraph on page 2. The Medrash, the source is called the Yalkut Shimoni. Now the Yalkut, again, so remember, Moab and Ammon are not allowed into the Jewish people because they did not have the capacity for kindness. You remember that? They did not greet the Jewish people with the bread and the water. They are excluded. By the way, what's the source? What's the source of Ammon and Moab? Where did they come from? Anybody know? It came from Lot. Now Lot was the nephew of Abraham. So there must have been kindness there somewhere, right? And Lot indeed treats the angels very nicely. Right? Lot carries chesed. And yet Ammon and Moab are not allowed into the Jewish people. Why? Because they do not demonstrate kindness. So you have to ask yourself the question of what happened to the kindness that once was there. So look at a very amazing medrash. Comes this last medrash and says, again, if we had time, we'd look in a deep way, but let's just get to the key idea here. Rabbi Avin said, "We gather from Scripture that there are wings to the earth, as it is said, from the uttermost parts of the earth we heard songs." And this phrase, uttermost parts, in Hebrew means knafayim, knafayim. "There are wings to the sun, as it is said, but unto you that fear my name shall the sun of righteousness arise with the healing in its wings." That is a pasuk in Malachi. "There are wings to the chayot, to the holy animals." And the Medrash continues, "There are wings to the kruvim, there are wings to the serafim." And then the Medrash says, this is the last three lines of the page, "Come and consider how great is the power of the righteous, and how great is the power of righteousness, and how great the power of those who do kindly deeds. For they shelter neither in the shadow of the morning, nor in the shadow of the wings of the earth, nor in the shadow of the sun, nor in the shadow of the wings of Chayot, or the Kruvim, or the Sarfim. But under whose wings do they shelter? Under the shadow of Him, of God, at whose word the world was created. As it is said, how preciousness is thy loving kindness, O God, and the children of men take refuge in the shadow of thy wings." In other words, what's the matter saying? If you do kindness, if you do really incredible kindness, who shelters you? God. Now, here's an amazing term. The phrase that the Medrash uses is lachasot, to seek shelter, tachat kanfei hashchina, under the wings of the Shechina. That is the exact same phrase that Boaz uses to Ruth when he says to her, I see how you have come lachasot tachat kanfei hashchina. In other words, the term for a convert is someone who seeks shelter under the divine wings. Now, if we do the math, and the Medrash tells us that what is the definition, or who is it that is privileged to seek shelter under the divine wings? Who is it? The one who does kindness. So then what must we conclude? That the convert, by definition, is defined as one who is engaged in kindness. And we have to ask why. What's the kindness of a convert? What's the chesed of a convert? What would you say? What's the kindness of a convert? Where's their kindness in the act of conversion?
Do you want to take on the mitzvah?
Good. So let's take a look.
How's that a kindness?
What? Well, I didn't define it yet. Let's go a little more.
Because they gave up.
Because they give up. Because they give up. The kindness is defined as I'm willing to do for the other. I'm willing to do for the other. Now let's take a look at this incredible act of kindness that defines every convert. And the ultimate and classic convert is Ruth. And that, of course, is the classic scene. Take a look with me. The classic scene. The classic scene is that of Ruth and Orpah. And I desperately hope that I have it here on this page. Look at source number 6. It's the best I can do. It's the best I can do. It's source number 5. No, source number 5 is also a little bit, but it's not what I need. The truth is, I don't have it as well. They should have it here. So let me, I'll show you what I mean by source number 6. Right? It's a good source. Okay. So let's just remember what happens here. Take a look with me at the last source on page 3. Okay? And it says that the last source, this is called the Medrash Rabbah on Ruth. And we are told that we have two women. Their name is Orpah. One's name is Orpah and the other one is Ruth. Now, the name Orpah and the name Ruth could simply be the name. But Chazal were not content, the rabbis were not content to assume that that was their name, and there were reasons why. In other words, the name Orpah sounds like a Hebrew name. That's pretty weird to name your Moabite child by a Hebrew name. And the Medrash also finds another name for Orpah, and the Medrash says, so what's the reason why the text calls her Orpah? And why is she called Ruth? And the Medrash says something which seems a little strange. You have it here. Last source, number 6. Shema Achat Orpah. One of them, her name is Orpah. Why is she called Orpah? So Orpah, if you're familiar a little bit with Hebrew, you know that the word Orpah means the back of the neck. The back of the neck. So the Medrash says, why is she called Orpah? Because Shehavcha Oref Lechamosa. She turned her back, she turned her neck away to her mother-in-law. The Jews are called a stiff-necked people. And the term for that is Kishay Oref. Why are we called Kishay Oref? Is the back of the neck. Rashi says, why are we called Kishay Oref? Because when you give a Jew Musar, he turns around and he walks away. Machzir Panav L'mochichehem. So the term Arpa, says the Medrash, is that's why she called Orpah. She is forever named Orpah because she turned away from her mother-in-law. And why is Ruth called Ruth? So if you say the name Ruth or Rus, you will see, and you listen to the word, says the Medrash, Rus Shera'a Sa Divrei Chamosa, because she saw the words of her mother-in-law. Now that's a very interesting comment, but it seems actually like it's just the opposite. why do I say that this medrash is counterintuitive? And it seems like it's counterintuitive. It seems like the medrash actually has it exactly backwards. Why? Because what did Naomi really want? What did Naomi, the mother-in-law, really want? When I gave you the storyline in the beginning, Naomi said, go. Don't be with me. I'm going to Israel. Stay here.
She wanted to see who was really testing her.
That could also be a part of it, right?
Well, that's like convert to me. Yeah.
Right? You push away three times. So the Medrash says that, even though Arpa says, no, I'm going with you. Once, twice, and then at a certain point in time, Arpa gives her mother-in-law a kiss, and she then leaves. Right. And the Medrash says, she is the one that didn't listen, even though really, she's the one that did listen. Because right. What did her mother-in-law say? Go! And Ruth, the one that didn't listen, says the Medrash, no, she saw deeply, she didn't say she heard her mother-in-law, because she actually didn't listen to her mother-in-law. She saw deeply into her mother-in-law. In other words, you know, sometimes people say, no, you don't really have to. You don't really have to make me dinner on Mother's Day with flowers and proper jewelry. You don't have to, but if you want to live a decent life for the next 6 months following, it might be advisable. You don't usually conclude the sentence that way, but it's pretty clear exactly what you mean. You didn't have to. I'll take it back. No. You don't have to take it. No, you don't have to take it back. You know, once you gave it to me, I'll keep it. You know what I'm saying? Like, so Rus, she saw her mother-in-law's words. In other words, the greatness of Rus is that she looked in a deep place and was able to see and assess the needs of her mother-in-law. And it's interesting. What Rus says is, I'm going with you. Your nation is my nation. And then she says, your God is my God. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, in general, conversion often starts with a social interaction. You know, there are some people who read the books and say, wow, Jews are amazing, fantastic. But, you know, it's like one out of every 10 converts. Usually it's, these Jews, yeah, something special about the Jewish this, and I was really impressed with this person. Usually it starts with a social interaction. So, Ruth says, wow, Naomi, I need to help her. It's an interesting thing. It's a very interesting thing. And this is one of my favorite pieces of Torah. I try to say this in the context of Rus and Arpa whenever I can. But we find that Rus and Arpa were very close. There was a lot that connected them. And yet, this moment of truth of Rus and Arpa with this moment with Naomi yields a massive and incredible chasm between Rus and Arpa, so much so that, and I say this tongue-in-cheek, that we actually have a tradition that there was a family reunion between Rus, a descendant of Rus, and a descendant of Arpa. They actually had a reunion. It wasn't a barbecue. It wasn't a very peaceful reunion. Anybody know what, but Tanya, you cannot answer. Does anybody here know what I'm referring to when I say there was a reunion between Rus and Arpa? No. It wasn't really them themselves. It was descendants. It was cousins. The cousins had a reunion. One cousin's name was David. The other cousin's name was Goliath. And according to our tradition, David and Goliath were first cousins. First cousins twice removed, I have to be honest. In other words, Goliath was the son of Arpa, and David was the great-grandson of Rus. And if you do the math, that's first cousins twice removed. Right? But they meet each other. It's amazing. They start so close, right? Rus and Arpa start so close. And yet, what happens is that there's this chasm because of this one decision. Because Rus is willing to give it all. Rus is willing to give it all. Bimoser Nefesh, the chesed of Rus, the chesed of leaving it all. Because at the end of the day, it was much better in Moab for Rus. According to our tradition, Rus was a princess. And she was willing to give it all. That's chesed. Now, let's skip a little bit ahead. Because there's another chesed, and I want to read to you a very fascinating line. So now, back to the story. Rus, Boaz is very impressed with Rus. He sees her for the first time. He sees the way she picks up the grain with modesty. She halachically appropriate. She doesn't take too much. And according to the Medrash, in these small actions, Boaz sees greatness in Ruth. And it's an interesting thing. I just want to show you fascinating Midrashic comment. Please take a look at the last page, source 7. The Medrash says that in the very last source, the very last source, on page on source 7, the Medrash says, actually, that's the last page, right? It's the third page. Boaz and little things. So, a very fascinating comment of the Medrash, last paragraph in source 7, another interpretation of Moshe, of now Moses was keeping the flock. It says, every word of God is tried. Before God confers greatness on a man, he first tests him by a little thing, and then promotes him to greatness. Here you have two great leaders whom God first proved by a little thing, found trustworthy, and then promoted to greatness. He tested David with sheep, which he led through the wilderness, and only in order to keep them from robbing private fields. And then the Medrash proves that point. And God said to him, the next line, thou hast been found trustworthy with the sheep. Come therefore and tend my sheep. Beautiful idea, no? Right? You need to see if somebody views, right, once heard this said, to a great person, there are no such thing as small things. Right? In other words, the details are holy, the holy details. So, what does Boaz see in Rus? Boaz sees in Rus an incredible care and attention to details, the way she collects the wheat, the grain, halachically appropriate. And therefore, Boaz asks about this young lady. And the Medrash says, it's weird that Boaz is asking about the woman. Boaz was older, and Boaz was a great and holy tzaddik. Why is he asking who this woman was? And he finds out about Rus. And now, I want to get to the sort of the main point, the crescendo here of this year. So then what happens is, so Ruth goes to sleep next to Boaz.
I mean, if you know, he was so worried about her being like, you know, modest, and then he wakes up and she's
sleeping. Well, that's not a question on him, it's a question on her.
Well,
right?
That's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It's a question on her.
That is a great, fantastic question.
You know, like, but he was impressed with her modesty there, but like,
that's a great, fantastic question.
But he understood about the evil because she uncovered his feet.
That's a great, fantastic question, and it needs to be understood. Really, the biggest question is on Naomi, right?
So he understood.
Right?
He understood that that's why she was doing it?
Yeah,
but still,
it's a pretty bold thing to do.
So I would like to read to you.
Not exactly modest.
It's not what we would consider, right?
You know,
right.
If they went like through the, you know, like, listen, she needs it because of evil. You know, someone, there was an intermediary, there was a shidduch.
Yeah, no, it's a very fantastic question.
There she is.
Hello.
No, he didn't die yet. He's still going to marry her, and then he dies the next day.
Okay, but he wants to die.
No. He died because he fulfilled his tachlis. He sired the Mashiach. But let me read to you the text here. So, Vayhi b'chatzi ha'layla, the middle of the night, Vayecherad ha'ish, the man wakes up startled. You can imagine?
Yeah.
It's a little startling. Vayhi l'afes, turned around, V'hineh ha'isha shochevet margalosav, there's a woman lying by his feet. Vayomer miyat, who are you? So what do you mean, who are you? He knew who she was, right? Okay. Batomer Anochi Rut Amatecha. I am Rus, your maidservant. Ufarasta Kinafecha Alamasecha. And you must, and I want you to spread your robe, your garment, over your handmaid. Ki Goel Ata, because you are a redeemer. And then, of course, what happens, as I said before, he goes to Ploni Amoni, right? And Ploni Amoni, his brother is not going to, his uncle is not going to do it. That's later on. Vayomer, listen to the words. This is that night. Vayomer. Brucha at Lahashem. You are a blessed one of God. Biti, heitavt chazdeich ha'acharon min harishon. This kindness, this last kindness, this is even greater than your first kindness. This kindness, this final kindness is even greater than your first kindness. What was it? What was Rus's first kindness?
Staying with
Naomi. Staying with Naomi. And what's this kindness?
Marrying an old man.
Marrying an old man. You sound like you really relate to that in a very, very personal way. So, Levilti leches acharei habachurim. You're not looking at the young chevra. Imdal v'im ashir. If they're poor, if they're wealthy. No, you're not doing that. You're looking at me. And I'm an old man. And he says to her, Berucha at, you are a blessed woman. So what's going on here? What's this? Why is this a better kindness? Maybe it's the same kindness. She's a Balas Chesed. She's a woman of kindness. She was kind with Naomi. And now she's being kind with Boaz. So why is this greater? What makes this Chesed greater than the Chesed with Naomi? What would you say?
She was one of the most beautiful women from that time. And she could have anyone.
Okay, so, but why? So she gave up. She gave up for Naomi. She gave up for Boaz. Why is this kindness greater?
In other words,
Boaz says to her, this last kindness is even greater than the kindness that you did the first time around. Well, and then he says, you are blessed. That's a very important phrase, you are blessed. We'll talk about that in a moment. No, what do you say? Why is this a greater kindness?
I just want to clarify. The kindness of her coming.
Of her coming and sticking with Naomi, that was the first. That was kindness number one, right? Uh-huh. Kindness number two is being willing to give up all the other men and to be with Boaz, and in the end, from this union, comes David HaMelech. Why is this a greater kindness, and why is she blessed because of it? Any thoughts on that? Why is it a greater kindness? Anybody?
Okay, we don't know. So
okay,
tell
no,
us.
No. What is it you think? Okay, fine. So let me tell you what I think is going on here. Okay? See, the first kindness of Ruth was a kindness, but in a certain sense she had no choice. Why? Why did Ruth have no choice? Because she knew the truth. She knew that Judaism, that Torah, is true. So yes, sometimes you have to give up, but if you know something is true, in a certain sense, you're compelled. Right? It's a chesed that comes from emes. But there's nowhere in the Bible that says that a young woman has to marry a man 50 years older than you. It doesn't say that in my Bible. So, this wasn't a chesed that came from an emes. This was a chesed that came from a chesed. In other words, this second kindness was a recognition that in this Boaz, there's something incredibly special, and therefore I don't have to marry him. I'm not bound. There was no halachic obligation. But I realize in him, I see in him a greatness, and therefore it's not simply that I'll see the truth. First time, I know that it's the truth. That's what Judaism is. The second time around, this time, I see in him something very special. I'm not bound at all to do this. But I know that it's the right thing. I know that there's a kedusha there. And what is that? What was that special thing? And how does this bring us to David? So I'll end with this. I'm obviously giving this short story to a big topic. Do you remember way back in the book of Bereishis, there was a man named Eliezer? And Eliezer is given a mission, and the mission is to find a shidduch for Yitzchak, right? But Eliezer has a bias. What's the bias?
He wants his daughter.
He wants his daughter. And Avraham tells Eliezer, it's not going to work. And he says to him, it's not going to work because, and without going into all the details, he says, because you're not from a blessed stock. You come from a cursed stock. And we always ask, that sounds like a little bit tough, doesn't fit into the Avraham personality. But comes Rav Shimon Schwab and he says, and what about Ruth? She came from not such a great stock. She came from Moab. And how did she end up bringing the Mashiach? How did she get in here?
Right.
So Rav Schwab says an amazing thing. Next time, when you open up the book of Ruth, you'll see, we find something in the book of Ruth that we do not find in any other place in Tanakh. And that is, there are times that you open up a book, a Megillah, it's written, certain letters are written, and you don't read it exactly the way it's written. That in the Torah is called Kri-Ktiv. It's read one way, and it's written another. But at least there's something in paper. But we find in the book of Ruth something that doesn't exist in any other place, and that is, there are places in the book of Ruth where the person who reads the book, reads the Megillah, has to utter words even though it's not on the paper. When Ruth says the word Eli, Eli means to me. In the context, for example, one place is, whatever you say to me, Naomi, I will do. Kol asher tomri Eli eseh. The word Eli does not appear in the Megillah when it's written. It doesn't appear there. But you have to say, if you don't say, you have not read the Megillah properly. You've misread a pasuk. So says Rav Schwab an amazing thing, that the difference between Eliezer and Rus was that Eliezer, and looking at the text, you'll appreciate it more. Eliezer, even though he wanted the right thing, he still had his ego involved. He still had his ulai. He still had his Eli. He still had a sense of, I'm something. The greatness of Rus, the ability for Rus to take the chesed that was in Moab and extract it and take out this incredible purity and fuse it with Boaz. And Boaz, and this is already a Hasidic Torah, but it's beautiful. Boaz, within Boaz was great strength. Within him, Malchus, strength, the kingdom. You need to fuse the chesed of Rus. The humility, if you have a king who's purely arrogant, you have a terrible thing. The greatness of David HaMelech is what? David HaMelech was Anochi Tolat V'lo Ish, I'm nothing. The three most modest people in the world, Adam, David, and Moshe. And maybe Avram is in there also. Avram, David, and Moshe. So, Rus is able to fuse into the Klal Yisrael because she has the kindness of Lot, and she has managed to completely filter out the arrogance. She has completely abnegated her desires first for Naomi, and that was a chesed that came from Emes, and then the second time, which is even greater than the first, a chesed that she didn't have to do. But she saw in Boaz something incredibly special. She saw in Boaz a righteousness. He saw in Boaz a kindness. And she said, I am beautiful and I can have whatever I want. But that's what's right for me. Receiving the Torah on Shavuos and tying into the book of Rus really means, on a basic level, that a Jew has to pull his or her own ego out of the story. The less ego, the more God. The more ego, the less God. And that's why the Gemara says that when a person who is completely arrogant enters the room, God says, I'm getting out of here. Ein ani vahu yecholin ladur bekfifa achas. This world isn't big enough for both of us. The notion that we're reading the book of Rus, who fuses into the Malchus based David, is the notion of the humility, the abnegation of self, the recognition that at the end of the day, to the degree that a human being is able to sort of make him or herself a vessel of kindness. And that's a tough thing. It's a tough thing to take the ego out of the room. right? Or at least to acknowledge the ego, right? To acknowledge that it's in the room. It's tough, because we're all invested in ourselves. But the notion of Rus fusing herself into Klal Yisrael is precisely because of that ability, that incredible ability to recognize and ultimately push aside what she wants for what she realizes is appropriate and ultimately will bring her to a greater place. So this is sort of a message, I think, that for each and every one of us on our own level, we have to think about. Well, before we walk into Shavuos, you know, what are our particular challenges of ego that sort of get us in the way, that get in the way of Kabbalah HaTorah? And to the extent that we can sort of take a stab at it, and we can sort of acknowledge it and make headway, we will have been fulfilling the Rus example, and we would have been fulfilling the idea of hachana, of preparation for the Kabbalah HaTorah. So thank you for listening, and everyone can ask. Yes, sure.
One thing I noticed, and it's really kind of cool, it's the only other time I ever saw